Welcome, everybody. My name is Karen St. Pierre, and I am a decades-long friend of Leanne's and a witness to her amazing journey all the way from New York to Tokyo to Jerusalem. And I am delighted to welcome everyone here. I think what might be a great idea is to introduce Leanne. Leanne Grunberg Wakabayashi is a journalist, artist, and teacher who lives in Jerusalem. She was born in Montreal on August 25th, 1959, and raised in New York City in a conservative Jewish home by European parents who had immigrated to the USA in their 30s. A lover of art and a keeper of diaries for as long as she can remember, she received a BA, magna cum laude, in art history from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and graduated from the MFA program in arts administration at Columbia University. She visited Japan for the first time in 1985 to research blockbuster art exhibitions in Tokyo department stores. A second assignment to Japan in 1987 led to an editing position in the newsroom of the Japan Times. 1 year in Tokyo led to marriage and permanent residency. Over more than 26 years of marriage, Leanne kept written records of the Eastern lifestyle and deep spiritual conversations she had with her Japanese family. With the birth of their two children, she began documenting her three-generation life in published articles, drawings, paintings, and photographs. So, Leanne, let's hear about the Wagamama Bride. I have a first question for you. You have been on quite the journey over the past 40 years. You've had a lot of adventures. You've had a lot of awakening, a lot of cultural, an infusion of culture in your life. Tell me, why did you decide to write your memoir?
It was an emotional decision that came about in the year 2012 when Aki's father had been diagnosed with fourth stage pancreatic cancer. And it was clear that he was dying, that he was going to die within a matter of months. And I started to realize that things were never going to be the same again. He was the patriarch of the family, and he was soft power. He was just a warm and fuzzy guy, and just did everything for the family that he possibly could as a peacemaker in Japan and with my family. He was just terrific. So I started to want to put down my recollections kind of in my own way of preparing for his passing, and as a tribute to my in-laws, because I've said it before, they were the other two wheels to this marriage. It was a four-wheeled vehicle, this marriage, from day one, and they did so much to support and encourage us and help us in any way they could, which is very unusual, which was why I felt I had to tell this story, because I know most people in my situation, women who marry into Japanese families, are not treated with such love and respect. And I thought, this is pretty unusual. I want to celebrate what was going on. And little did I know that the passing of my father-in-law would be the first of, I'm sorry to say, quite a few tragedies in my life that would happen over the next 5 years.
So this is a great time to perhaps read your first selection and take it away.
Okay, thank you. So just a little bit of a background in case you don't know much about this story. This is a celebration from the banquet of my 30 years of life in Japan in a Shinto Buddhist household with a Taoist husband, and me returning to Judaism slowly but surely, and then surpassing anything that I ever imagined possible, which was becoming an Orthodox Jew. So this is the beginning of an early chapter where you get to see the bar, where the bar was in my life as far as how I perceived my Judaism. And this is the first time I'm taking a new date, Aki, to the Jewish Community Center in Tokyo. And it's his first time there, first time in a Jewish setting. And he's got all kinds of questions. And that's what made our marriage very interesting. He had lots of interesting questions, and we kind of volleyed them back and forth. So this is chapter 3. It's called The Courtship. At my next visit to the White Crane Clinic, I discovered that Ichiro's nickname was the Prince. With a name like that, I wondered what could be his family background. He sure exuded confidence. When he was in the treatment room, there was a happy buzz that was hard to pinpoint. I only discovered on the day he was absent that this human commotion originated from Ichiro himself. His guffaws were greater, his voice louder, and his speech faster than the other therapists. On the day he was absent, Enya played over the speakers, and a soundtrack that normally lifted me up actually got on my nerves without Ichiro's laughter in the foreground. That very night, Ichiro called me to apologize. I'm not able treating you today. My grandmother passing away. I hardly knew what to say. Therapists don't usually call their patients at home to apologize for canceling an appointment. It sounds serious. Is she in the hospital? No, she passing away. She having a stroke because of high blood pressure and doesn't listening to her doctor warning about salty diet. I got it. Ichiro was referring to the past. I'm so sorry. I'd like to inviting you to the funeral, he blurted out. A date with a coffin. That would be something. I was tempted to say yes, but I hadn't even met his parents. I'm sorry, but I can't, I said. The funeral coincided with big transitions. I had just quit my job on the international desk at the Japan Times. I was about to be starting an intensive course in Japanese in the mornings and editing for a translation house in the afternoons. You're a journalist. Japanese funeral, quite interesting, he said. We believe that Amida, another name for Buddha, coming with his attendants to greet dying person and escort him at death. Escort him where? This was becoming interesting. We reborning in a place called the Pure Land in the West, where we listening to the teachings of Amida in order to become Buddhas. Reincarnation, that I could handle. I explained to Ichiro that Jews too had their own Amida, and it was a standing prayer. This was odd. I wondered if there was a connection between 3,500-year-old Judaism and the Amida Buddhism originating near Kyoto 800 years ago. Amida, meaning upright, is the most sacred of Jewish prayers, where you pour your heart out and ask God for anything you need, forgiveness, healing, and peace. You have lots of teaching me. I never meet another Jew except for Lalenya, Ichiro said. Ichiro's openness to Judaism was surprising and led me to proposing that we go to a Shabbat lunch at the Jewish Community Center. The Shabbat after his grandmother's cremation, we took seats overlooking the community center swimming pool, which was empty of swimmers because, as I explained to Ichiro, Jews don't swim on the Sabbath. I visualized the next day poolside, strip down, apply sunblock, and dive in. Why don't you swimming on the Sabbath? Ichiro asked while we gazed down at a rectangular turquoise pool surrounded by empty chaise lounges. It's not just swimming. It's study, work, sports, TV, movies, you name it. Tai hen. Yes, it's difficult. That's why I don't do it, I laughed, never imagining that one day I would fall in love with Shabbat, precisely because there was no work demand and especially no screens to check. Following tradition, we found empty seats together, and after a blessing over the wine, we got up to join a line for washing hands. We chatted as we returned to our seats, oblivious to a few glares. Someone shushed us, so we shut up until the rabbi blessed the challah. Afterward, he passed around thick slices of moist, honey-tinted bread, tempting as cake, and we were free to speak again. Should I? I was following Ichiro's recommendations for a macrobiotic diet and therefore in a quandary about whether to go ahead and enjoy the challah. George Osawa railed against refined white sugar and white flour and discouraged eggs. I used to love challah, but sitting by Ichiro, not only my shiatsu therapist, but my macrobiotic counselor, I hesitated. Come on, Ichiro said. Becoming too rigid about diet, not healthy either. He had a point. I tried biting into the sweet challah, but I couldn't go further. I had been feeling more energetic without the refined flours and sugars. Ichiro didn't see any apparent contradiction between being macrobiotic, follower at the White Crane Clinic, and a challah eater in a Jewish setting. This flexibility worked for him, and I admired him for that. He ate slice after slice of challah. He then doled neat little hills of egg salad, potato, and tuna salads onto his plate until the roast chicken arrived. This is Shabbat. I love resting on Oshogatsu, Japanese New Year. How often are you do Shabbat? Every Friday night from sundown until Saturday night sundown. He looks surprised. Every week? Just doing this? That's amazing, but why? Do you want the long or the short reason? I replied. Einat, a university professor with glasses and a bird-like trill in her voice, helped me out. Pointing at the pinhole lights or perhaps the heavens above the ceiling, she explained to Ichiro that since God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh, the Jewish people followed God's lead and observed a day of rest too. I turned to Ichiro and nodded in recognition. Einat is a scholar, an expert on Jewish history, culture, and law. She probably knows more about my own religion than I do. You bringing me here today, so this important to you, being Jew, not just brain knowledge, it's something you're carrying in your heart, no? I admitted my feelings. You either accept your family's values or you rebel against them. You thinking like a rebel? My grandmother's harsh letter came to mind. Not really, but some members of my family have made me out to be so. His next admission caught me off guard. I rebelling too. He told me that his parents wanted him to follow his father's and his grandfather's footsteps and become an engineer so that he could someday take over the family rice polishing company. He got accepted into engineering college and went. But once I getting there, I'm more interested reading Dostoevsky than study mechanical engineering. After 2 years, I quitting. Just like that, you quit college? I was stunned. I couldn't imagine quitting midstream. Well, I didn't attend many classes, he chuckled while stroking a few wisps of sparse beard. But I reading all the time till I getting idea to travel. I wanting to find the source of Buddhism. So I go to Nepal, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and India. Death is main reason families go to temple in Japan. But Buddhism, not just for funerals. So in India, I learning more about Shakyamuni Gautama, founder of Buddhism. He born in foothills of Nepal to a family of royalty and not allowed out of palace grounds because his father, the king, wanting him to see only pleasureful life. When he becoming an adult, he do so anyway, and he's shocked when he's seeing real life. He's seeing an old man, a sick man, a corpse, and a yogi for first time. That made him deciding to leave his family, becoming a wanderer. Then he's sitting under a Bodhi tree for 7 weeks, meditating to escape samsara, the endless cycle of birth and rebirth. There he become Buddha. He experiencing Satori, enlightenment. Enlightenment, now that's an ambitious goal. A state of eternal peace and equanimity. Didn't sound so bad. And just think of all the teaching credentials. Yes, teaching is noble profession, he said. I'm finding a Buddhist priest and he teaching me this. Only repeating name of the Buddha with all your heart, whether walking or standing, sitting or lying, never cease for a moment. This is the practice which results in salvation. Those words sounded so familiar. Each night before I sleep, I recite the Shema, which says the same thing, to love God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Teach these commandments thoroughly to your children and speak of them while you sit in your home, while you walk on the way, when you retire, and when you arise. You call in your way Judaism, and I call in mine Buddhism, the Tao, and of course, all cosmic wisdom coming from the same source. We having this choice to find God wherever we going, whatever happening, the good and not so good. So much to process here. I had no idea that prayers found in the thousands of years of Jewish liturgy would show up in the Buddhist practice. Did you find a teacher in your travels? I asked. I'm finding the best, Ichiro said. I expected Ichiro to name Sai Baba, Osho, Iyengar, an Indian guru or yogi of such renown that even I knew the name. I'm having two gurus, hepatitis and malaria, he said with lips tightening. I'm getting very sick in India, so I go back to Japan early. I lying in bed at my parents' house, my parents taking me to Tokyo University Hospital, but even the doctors can't find a cure. Finally, my parents meeting an acupuncturist, and he telling me to eat 2 small meals, macrobiotic every day, and run 10 kilometers. I getting cured, even though it's not easy to eating and running in that condition. I trying my best. That's how I coming to be interesting in Eastern medicine. I wanted to understand the consciousness that brings healing. Wow, your parents love you so much to have searched the way they did. That was some ordeal to go through, I said, as I looked into his healthy eyes and couldn't imagine him sick. Yes, my mother and father, great parents. I took you to meeting them, if you like. I was so preoccupied with decoding our conversation that I didn't realize other conversations were going on around us. Jews never say rules. Neil was a Tokyo University doctoral student in ichthyology and wore a kippah adorned with goldfish. Besides knowing a lot about goldfish, Neil knew a lot about Torah law too. Rules, commandments, what's the difference? Someone across the table gestured as he waved a slab of salmon from the tip of his fork. They're mitzvot, good deeds, kindnesses. Each time we practice a mitzvah, we strengthen our bond to Hashem, our God. A mitzvah is about common decency and self-respect. You know, the golden rule, do not do unto others as you wouldn't want them to do unto you. Quite right. I know that in my brain, but I've never felt it here, I said, pointing to my heart. I turned to Ichiro and put down my napkin. I'm clueless how to even begin. Torah has so many rules, 613 commandments. A burst of song cut off our conversations. This was the Birchat HaMazon, the blessing after the meal. I didn't know the words to catchy melodies that went on and on, page after page. Everyone else at the table seemed to know the tunes, could read the words in Hebrew, and participation seemed like rollicking fun if you could just sing along. But I couldn't. And so Ichiro and I just sat there, discovering something else we had in common.
Excellent, Leanne.
Thank you.
Wow, what a journey. What insights in a single chapter, in a single conversation. This is a pretty auspicious beginning to quite a life together.
It was. It was. It just goes to show what a good backdrop could do. You know, some settings are conducive to opening conversations and diving right in to getting to the heart of knowing somebody. And there's nothing like taking somebody to your spiritual home in order to see how they respond, in order to see if they're on board or open or defensive or whatever it is they react to. And I have to give Ichiro a lot of credit for opening up to the experience. Yes. And in turn, opening me up to knowing more about my own religion.
Your connection seems to be faded on a lot of levels. And I was wondering if you would like to go on to the wedding chapter, or if you would like to discuss this chapter in a little more detail.
Maybe what we could do is take one or two questions and see if somebody wants to ask something about this chapter, excerpt from the chapter.
Did you have the same experience in reverse, going to something of his and understanding it, or, you know, your experience with it?
I have to say that yes. And that was because I was introduced to the family basically at the funeral of his grandparents, grandfather. I missed the grandmothers. But I was thrown right into the spiritual deep end of one of the most sacred moments in the family's life. And there I was, a fly on the wall to it. And so, yes, I did ask questions. And yes, I was very fascinated by the answers that I got. So yes, it is in the book. Definitely. Good question, Clara. Thank you.
We have about 10 minutes. Would you like to read another piece?
Yeah, I think you'd like to hear the wedding, the his and her wedding chapter.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read a part of it. And then we'll move on. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm starting each of the chapters with short excerpts from the Psalms, King David's Psalms. And I do that because the Psalms are what sustains me as life gets harder and harder, as I start reading the prayers daily to fortify me, to help me keep going, and to know that there's some higher intelligence that understands what's going on and protecting me, even if I don't understand. And so this was, you know, as they say, first you do, then you understand. So that was what I was doing, reading the Psalms, doing and then understanding later. So this is his and hers weddings. Give me understanding and I will keep your Torah and preserve it with all my heart. Psalm 119. Zohara made a fine rabbi. She stood before Ichiro and me with a prayer book in her hands, wearing flowing wine-colored robes. She read the wedding benedictions in Hebrew. Ichiro and I sipped from the same wine glass. I looked up at the basement ceiling. No bolt of lightning came to strike us down. I couldn't help noticing the look of mourning in my father's eyes as he watched Ichiro slip the gold band onto my finger. My mother modeled to him the stiff upper lip. My father took a cloth napkin and wrapped it around a glass goblet. Even in happy times, we must remember the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, my father began. Why are he choosing to telling us now? Ichiro whispered in my ear. Because we Jews are still in mourning, waiting for the Messiah to arrive, my father explained. Then when he does, with God's help, we can rebuild the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. Amen. I stood next to Ichiro under the beautiful lace veil that Pauline, my mother's older cousin, with whom she shared the mysterious grandfather Avraham, had worn over her hair. to her wedding at St. Peter's Church, just east of Maidenhead. Ichiro smashed the glass goblet with his shoe heel. Sohara pronounced us man and wife. My mother smiled at my mother-in-law. My father handed Ichiro's father a drink. My family had met their match in Ichiro's broad-minded and adventurous parents. With the chuppah above us, I visualized that bright, sunny horizon. The following day, Sunday, April 7th, we emerged from the subway station and ran the last 100 meters to the Imperial Hotel with our umbrellas tossing and turning against torrential rains. What a day to get married, I muttered as I brushed off raindrops from my warm winter coat. Rain bringing good luck to marriage, it meaning wedding will last, Ichiro said. I smiled, grateful for his positivity, as we rushed through the lobby, decked out in a fantastic display of sakura, cherry blossoms. The arrangement was set on a table at the approach to the grand staircase. Branches with pink flowering petals had been packed into a vase to create the optical illusion of a cherry blossom bush, a feat that only a master flower arranger could pull off. As we stood before the cherry blossoms, Ichiro recalled a kotowaza, an old Japanese saying, marriage like a knot. When it getting wet, it became very hard to untie. From the pink carnations grown in greenhouses to the classical string quartet playing Vivaldi, almost everything in our Imperial Hotel tying of the knot had come out of a hotel wedding showroom catalog. It was a point and pay wedding of the highest order, with Ichiro's parents doing most of the pointing and practically all of the paying from the gift money brought by the guests. We were not going to receive any of it. If that didn't send up a red flag, it should have. But I didn't say a word about the financial arrangements to my parents. You should be so thrilled, my mother whispered as she adjusted my pearl tiara in the bridal dressing room. I'm not much of an actress, and I think she saw the tears that came to my eyes after I put on the Yumi Katsura designer gown, a confection of Thai silk with puffy long sleeves and a huge bow and train at the derriere. There was no backing out now. All that remained was faith that I was going with the right gut instinct, a sunny horizon. I clutched my bouquet of trailing white orchids. Ichiro walked alongside me in a black tuxedo as we entered a Shinto shrine somewhere in the bowels of the Imperial Hotel. We came before a cedar altar offering tangerines and nothing else, because true to what Ichiro had told me, Shintoism rejects statuary and forbids idol worship as much as Judaism does. The Shinto priest and his tall son, my neighbors, bowed to us slowly, one in a regal purple robe, the other in wizard-like lime green, topped off by impressive headgear that was soft, black, and helmet-like. Ichiro translated what the priest was saying, something about our marriage being a union of our two cultures. I nodded, seeing the obvious, that this was my union to their culture. Our family sat opposite each other on facing pews. Parents, sisters, brothers, cousins, aunts, and uncles scrutinized our every move as Ichiro and I traded three rounds of sake, which we drank from red lacquer dishes, something that could be described as a hybrid between a cup and a plate. A shrill flute hailed us ceremoniously. My father peered through his thick aviator lenses, adjusted his tuxedo bow tie, his mouth creasing toward his chin. My mother and my sister Talia wore matching black velvet cocktail dresses with princess necklines, slender waists, and gathered skirts, which they had coincidentally snapped up on separate shopping trips. I thought to myself, how incredible. This could only happen between a mother and daughter on the same wavelength. Mom's fiance, Leon, squinted through his bifocals, and my 80-year-old great aunt Vicky on my father's side adjusted the little silver pillbox hat, and floor-length lamé sheath gown that she had sewn for the occasion. My divorced parents and their spouses had rallied to support me, doing the right thing by wearing black in accordance with Japanese wedding custom and looking, to all appearances, like a jolly united front. We moved to the South Peacock Room for the banquet. Ichiro and I took our seats at the dais, just us and our nakodo, the go-betweens. It was still a custom when we married for those who truly or symbolically made the marriage match to be the only ones given the honor of joining the bride and groom on the dais. Go-betweens are typically a happily married older couple. Our go-betweens were middle-aged and married, but not to each other. These two were actually meeting for the very first time on the dais because our real go-between, the president of the Columbia University Alumni Association of Japan and my very first friend in Tokyo, had been rushed to the hospital with fourth stage cancer. Now, how about that to start a wedding office auspiciously, I said to myself. I looked out onto our guests sitting elegantly attired in dark suits and kimonos. Our wedding guests were mostly men of Ichiro's father's generation. I was reminded of the annual dinners I had worked in New York while on staff at Columbia Business School. I would greet the future business leaders of America, mostly men, with a smattering of women. The round tables, the fine tableware, the waiters in tuxedos were all so familiar. It was almost deja vu, except for Vivaldi's Four Seasons playing in the background. Ichiro's master, Incho Sensei, was the first to speak at the podium. He talked about the Taoist way of life that I would be joining. As it was a rather complex life, Incho spoke and spoke while the wine goblets remained empty and the plates stone cold. I peered into the faces of Ichiro's aunts and uncles, his cousins, his brother and sister, who listened with eyes closed. Perhaps they were used to these long speeches, but I certainly was not. I became a drowsy fly on the wall, finding it increasingly hard to stay awake for my own wedding. Ichiro leaned over, whispering in my ear, sweet wake-up music. I couldn't wait to take you in my arms. A glass clinked on the far side of the room, signaling that it was speech time again. Karen, my dear friend who had come from New York, cleared her throat as she took the podium. I have shared laughs and adventures with Leanne in New York, London, and Tokyo, all the cities she has called home. When I recall those early days we shared in glitzy Manhattan, when nervously starting my first job in the public relations department of the Museum of Broadcasting, I was welcomed by a smart, impish woman with an easy smile, self-confident, and a quick take-no-prisoners sense of humor that put me immediately at ease. It meant a lot to have my best friend in the world remind me not only of this life I had left, but to make the best of myself in this marriage too. Then Karen pulled out of her purse a wrinkled old napkin and my mouth dropped open. "Don't tell me you saved that," I gasped. "Sure did," Karen smiled as she began. "I do declare that I, Leanne Grunberg, will never ever marry a Japanese man." The room burst into laughter. "Leanne, you are embarking on an interesting life, a fascinating marriage." I joined the laughter because I thought, how ludicrous. Why would I have written such a thing under the influence of a glass of wine? My mother appeared at the dais to snap close-ups. She planted a kiss on my Nakodo Yoko's cheek and whispered in my ear as if mind-reading what I needed to hear. "Leanne, Yoko would never have agreed to be here for you if she didn't believe in the chances of this marriage's success." "Mom, you're right. Yoko is a true friend," I whispered back. "But what does she know about foreign marriages? This is a wild experiment for all of us." My mother shot me a look of concern. "Struth, don't tell me you're having misgivings." "Mom, if I can't say it to you, who can I tell?"
Wow. Holy Anne. Wow. What an evocation of that day.
And so this true. Is the Karen of the napkin.
Yes, the Karen of the napkin. Know,
she probably still has that napkin.
You know, I may. And when I find it, I'll send it to you. However, I do seem to recall saying one thing after what an interesting journey you will be on. And that is, it must have taken a remarkable Japanese man to win your heart. And certainly that Aki Ichiro is a remarkable man. So I do remember saying that. It wasn't totally. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So, wow. Wow. And from that beginning, a journey, a huge journey, children, adventures, creating your Genesis Art Lounge and creating your intuitive art practice, which we all share now. Leanne, we're now at the 9 o'clock point, but if you would like to start discussing your process of memoir and sure. taking more questions, we can do that.
I think that would be great. You, Karen, it started with a question that I asked you to hold. So do you
yes.
want to begin yeah. with it?
Well, yes. I think the question has to do with how you have decided to edit this. You have so much in your life to share, but you chose a particular narrative arc to tell. And I want to know why you decided, how you chose the things to include and how you decided what to leave out. I know that's a big question, but a little prompt to get you going.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. Well, I noticed around the time that I started the memoir, 2012, I look back on my writing and 95 or 98% of it had nothing to do with Judaism. About nothing, very little had to do, in relatively speaking, maybe out of a couple of hundred articles, five were on Judaism. But to me, that was not representative of how I felt about my faith or the trajectory, the Jewish path that I was on. And I thought, I've got to rectify it, because I had a fourth grade teacher who always reminded us that today could be your last day on earth. And that was, she left me to remember. And that kind of made me think, do what you can do today. Don't put it off till tomorrow. And I thought, I'm going to start rectifying that by really devoting this memoir to look not only at the celebration of my life in Japan, but how Judaism figured into it and how much I changed as a result of the arrival of Chabad House or the Chabad movement in the year 2000. So for the last 17 years that I was in Japan, I was very, very much influenced and inspired by what was happening there. And it was a different planet to me. It was, and look, when NASA lands on the moon, they bring their researchers because everything's a different planet. Everything's new. You've got to take notes. You've got to document. So I had created this life in a way because it was so rich to document. And so I was there. I was trained. I had trained myself to do it. That was what I did.
In the course of the book, you create a beautiful parallel as you are discovering your own Judaism. You're rediscovering your heritage. And at one point, you share your experiences in London. Why did you bring London into the story?
Well, London was there from the beginning. Originally it was in the middle of the book, but it was such a pivotal moment in my life because it was the last time that I would see my mother alive, that I was advised by a dear friend and a former writing student, Susanna Jones, who's the best-selling author of The Earthquake Bird, which was made into a movie, a Netflix movie. So when she speaks, I listen. And when she said to me, Leanne, that's a really powerful chapter. why don't you start the book with that and with London? And so that was my reason to do so, because it was the last time I saw my mother. We were all gathered together, and it really showed it in that scene of sitting at the table. And a lot of this book takes a place around various dinner tables, the dinner tables of my life. So there we were, my 83-year-old uncle is preparing a meal for us, and I'm reflecting on feeling yet again an outsider within my own family. And I'd gotten used to being an outsider in my Japanese family. That was normal. That was obvious. That was what I chose. And here I was kind of reflecting on the irony of being an outsider to my own family too. And I don't say that in a way that is poor me, or that it actually was interesting to see that. It was a kind of, oh wow, moment that I knew without a doubt that this was the path for me. And at the same time, I could accept that they were on their paths, that what they had chosen was perfect for them. And there was something beautiful that we could all sit around and accept that we were all on our own journeys. So that's really where I wanted to start the book. Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful opening. It's a beautiful opening.
Thank you.
To, especially with the connection to your ancestors. You talk about your great-great-grandfather.
Great-grandfather,
and how he disappeared from the family. And there was a mystery at the beginning, and your book is a bit of a mystery, because we don't know what your outcome will be. I mean, we know what, because of where you are now and the changes in your life, but the journey of unraveling the mystery of discovering your Jewish heritage is previewed in that opening chapter, and your great-grandfather's energy is in the book. It's wonderful. What did you enjoy most about writing this? Was there a particular chapter that you really enjoyed writing, or a particular segment that brought you a lot of happiness to share?
I would say that writing is, I don't, people often call it a lonely process, but I didn't see it so much as alone. It was a spiritual practice. This is what I do. I spend 1 or 2 hours a day writing. But for me, it's always been about sharing. I love the opportunity to share the process of writing it, talking it. And I had a whole tribe of other writers in Japan who I'd get together with and share the writing. And one of the peak moments was in the year 2015. When I got on stage with 3 published writers and they're reading from their newly published books. One of them was the best-selling author, Tracy Slater, who wrote a book about her marriage to a Japanese man called The Good Shufu. It's a beautiful book. So that moment where I read from my printout, my A4 printout, and it was the meeting Ichiro at the clinic chapter. And I can't tell you how much in the hard times ahead that just people cheering me on meant the world to me, that it kept me going through some really, really hard times ahead, because writing this book, as you could imagine, a lot happens over 9 years, and especially my multinational families, the story of that took me through 4 countries over that time. It really helped to know and remember that moment where people are saying, finish the book, we want to laugh more with you. And I would say that was a big lesson for me too, Karen, and for everybody, is that humor is healing. Humor is a way of stepping back and making peace with your life story. And just sitting with the material, sometimes I would sit with it and saying, I'm going to sit with it until I can find something funny to process here. And that all came out of sharing it with other people.
That's great.
So
that's
Karen, great. You want to open it up to
others? Yes, we have a question from Michaela, and it's in the chat. Here's the question.
And Michaela was in my writing tribe in Tokyo. She was one of my dear angel friends. So that's
there she is.
Rhode Island now.
From Michaela. We spent a lot of time together during the early years of your marriage, and I remember you warning me how hard it is to go home. That conversation stuck with me and inspired me to take up the challenge. How did you decide, when you knew you were ready to go, to make Israel your home instead of the U.S.? Do you talk about this in your book?
Well, the truth was that my parents had both passed away by the time that that decision was on the table. So, and losing both parents, you basically lose home. You know, there wasn't home to return to. That was one thing that I have to say right out. And the other was, I discussed it in the book, so I'll bring it up here. My main concern was not escaping from Japan, because I had a wonderful life there and I loved it and I miss it. But I needed to very seriously help my daughter get treatment. My daughter has bipolar disorder. She had experienced episodes and hospitalizations in Tokyo, and the treatment there is, I don't want to say cruel and ruthless, but somewhere on that spectrum. Okay. So we were told by our Chabad rabbi in Rebbetzin that Israel is much more compassionate, that she could get really good treatment, really good care, that she could restart her life here, reset her life. And I went on faith. I just went on the faith that we had to give it a try.
Astrid, hello.
Hello. My question is, up to what point one can be really sincere in while writing memoirs, especially when you have sons, daughters, I mean, that are going to read what you write. And, you know, sometimes being a mother, sons, daughters, maybe they don't want to know so much about the mother as an individual or how the mother sees them. My question is around self-censorship, thinking about your children, let's say.
Well, that's a really great question, Astrid. And I spoke to my children and I read to them sections from the memoir. And I made sure that it was okay with them to talk about my daughter's bipolar disorder. And I checked in. So that was, of course, very important to do. I would say this, that the whole time I worked on this book and even before, rather than reading other people's memoirs, I read very few memoirs during that time, but instead I read a lot of spiritually uplifting material in order to understand what is this life journey about, what we're here to do. And one of the things that really impressed me is that we're here to be of service to other people. We're here to elevate other people. We're here to celebrate other people's lives. We're here not to spread rumors and gossip and bad feelings. You know, I got that. And I also had the experience that whenever I went in that direction, something would happen that wasn't very nice. And so I learned how to rein it in and not do it. And so I thought, well, is it a lie to celebrate a life and not tell the hardships, you know, tell the real, what we would call the icky stuff. And then I thought to myself, well, what really is the icky stuff except things that we created in order to have a lesson. And if I've learned the lesson, then I don't need to share that lesson. I got the lesson and let other people learn their own lessons. But I instead wanted to focus on the love aspect between our family members. And there's plenty of conflict in the book. I'm not saying you can't have conflict, but the idea of us working toward peaceful resolutions always in the background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's a very, very interesting and good answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Good.
Leanne, there's some lovely comments in the chat. Just one from, and I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing their name, but from Nekama Dina Hendel. Beautiful, thought-provoking book, Leanne. Thanks so much for sharing with us. And from Michaela, love where your heart is, Leanne. And lots of hugs and kisses.
Thank you.
We're kind of coming down to the last 5 minutes of this podcast. And I'd like for you to talk a little bit about Goshen Books, because you have created a platform for Wagamama Bride and a platform to support other authors. Can you talk a little bit about Goshen Books and how everyone can access information about it?
Sure. So goshenbooks.com is my publishing entity. It's my publisher. And so basically as an author, there's Leanne the author and Leanne the publisher, and I have to have them interact with each other. Although a lot of the times Leanne, the author, is too busy scrolling and looking at YouTube, and Leanne, the publisher, is saying, get back to work. So I'm trying to make a balance in this new role that I'm playing. And I tried in the beginning, I thought, I'm going to find an agent. I'm going to do what my friends do. I'm going to get an agent. And you spend a lot of time writing letters to agents and putting together a package. And it gets really tiring and really discouraging fast, even with positive letters. But more than that, I thought to myself, wait a minute, I've published 5 or 6 books before. I've already published. You know, I go to, they're on Amazon, the books, Kyoto Romance, To Live As We Are, Through the Eyes of Illusion, The Genesis Way. What am I thinking? I am a publisher. I'm a publisher without a name. So give myself a name. And so I arrived at the title Goshen Books because Goshen was the fertile region of Egypt where Jacob, the Israelite, and his brought the tribes when his son Joseph was the viceroy of Egypt. And so they settled in this fertile land, and this was their coming home, far from home, which is a theme in the kind of memoirs that I'm interested in publishing. Stories about people who have remade themselves, reinvented themselves, transformed themselves far from home. So Goshen Books was the name that I chose. And as we know in the story, you get comfortable in a place, but you're never really home. This is just the reality. There's always that place that you return to in childhood. And this, for the Jewish people, became the land of Israel, that we became slaves in Egypt. We were there for hundreds and hundreds of years before we made the long journey across the Sinai back home. So there is this double play that now I'm back from Goshen and back home. And so the book, the Goshen Books, in the future, my aim is to introduce the wonderful memoirs of people I know, wonderful writers I know, writers I don't know, and to give them a platform similar to what we're doing now, which is once a month, Meet the Author series, where we have the authors read and then answer questions about the writing process, similar to what we're doing now.
Thank you, Leanne. Thank you. It's now 9:30 in New York, and I'm gathering 4:30 in Jerusalem. And we're coming to the end of our talk. Any final things you would like to say, Leanne? I certainly want to thank everybody for joining us. And it's so great to see some faces from Tokyo, that like Everett, and to see Pavel and Michaela and Leanne. Would you like to say goodbye?
I just say thank you for joining me. I was really excited about doing this. I really appreciate your coming. Really, I'm very grateful that you took time from your day to celebrate with me the launch of this book. There's going to be a printed edition here in Jerusalem, a printed edition in Tokyo if you want to order directly from us. If you want signed copies or dedicated copies, you could order through me and I send it out from Jerusalem. If you want the fast track, you just go to Amazon and order from Amazon. And if you want to read essays from the book, thanks to Nechama Dina Hendel, wonderful Nechama Dina, she introduced me to Chabad.org, which I think is the number one or number two Jewish website in the world. And they are taking a series of excerpts from the memoir. So I'm very happy to say you could read, if you just Google my name on Chabad.org, Chabad.org, you'll be able to read along some of the other stories from the book.
Excellent.
And thank you, Karen. Thank you. Karen and I go back to 82. We go back a long way. Karen has followed me on this journey, and it's more than an honor. It's like a miracle too that we reached this day where we could celebrate together. So really,
thank you, Leanne. You are a friend of great courage and adventure, and it is incredible to be witness and kind of a life partner in this journey with you. Unexpected from those first days in New York in the 80s. And now the world is wide open to us. So thank you. Thank you for your friendship.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. I believe that everyone has a memoir within waiting to be born, and we can look back on our lives with gratitude and pride for growing beyond the limitations that society and our family background may have put before us, to discover the blessings of a life outside the comfort zone, to share stories that can inspire the friends and family who may not have understood us till now, and the many who have walked in our ways and are much in need of a role model. To call yourself a memoir writer begins the day you commit to telling your story. That's why I started GoshenBooks.com, to provide you with the tools and the incentive to complete your memoir. Get private coaching directly from me. One session can give you the focus you need, and regular weekly sessions will keep you on track to keep you motivated, accountable, and confident that your story matters, your life matters. You've got what it takes. Now go for it. Finish your book. Read the testimonials, the reviews, and sign up at GoshenBooks.com.